So, Ms. Wolfgram, let's just check your connection when you get a chance. Make sure you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you.
Excellent. And we can hear you. So I think we're on track. And thanks very much for your persistence. We appreciate it. So today's date is February 10th, 2021. I will ask the marshal to call us into session.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfield, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfield presiding. Now calling State of Minnesota versus Jeffrey Bond Troyer, case number A200832.
So I have just a few remarks before we proceed with arguments today, and most of them are probably things you already know, but I just wanna make sure my connection with you stays solid and that you understand a couple of things. First of all, we are proceeding today via Zoom, but our actual procedures are the same as they are in a regular courtroom. And so if you have any questions about that, ask us, but we plan to proceed as we always do in a courtroom. And the matter, first matter on our calendar has been called, and that's State versus Troyer. We have a total of five matters on our calendar today. Three of those are oral. And so we are ready to proceed with arguments. I'll ask both attorneys to identify themselves with the record before they start their remarks, as well as the client you represent, and then keep an eye on the clock. That should be visible on your screen and it will count down, letting you know how much time you have remaining. So with that, we're ready for counsel for the appellant to begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeffrey Sheridan. I am the attorney for Jeffrey Troyer, who is the appellant in this case. The matter is before this court on a direct appeal from Mr. Troyer's conviction for the misdemeanor offense of having an alcohol concentration of 0.08 or more within 2 hours of driving. The matter was submitted to the district court on stipulated facts to preserve Mr. Troyer's right to have the appellate courts review a pretrial order denying his motion to suppress evidence, including the results of his breath test, whose administration would have been preserved on a video recording made and then destroyed by the state. In this appeal, we are asking this court to determine, as 13 other states have, that the insurmountable threshold established in Arizona versus Youngblood before the state can be sanctioned for its destruction of evidence is inadequate to protect the due process and fair trial rights under Minnesota's constitution. Excuse me. We are asking this court to determine that under the Minnesota Constitution, a person's liberty is entitled to at least as much due process protection as that person's money and property, and that the same type of balancing that takes place in a civil case when one party destroys evidence before the other party has a chance to review it be applied to criminal cases as well. In a civil case, the standard applied is under the category of law known as spoliation of evidence. When a party destroys evidence without the other party having an opportunity to review it in advance, the court in a civil case will engage in a balancing and among the many factors to be considered in that balancing includes whose possession was the evidence in at the time it was destroyed? Was it material and is it something that is potentially helpful to the other party? And how has the destruction of that evidence affected the other party's ability to present their case? In this instance, we are talking about a video recording that is acknowledged to have been made of the testing process of Mr. Troyer's breath that we know existed and was requested in a timely fashion by Mr. Troyer. In fact, in the letter that requested that the evidence be preserved, there was also a caution included in that letter that indicated that you need to be careful with this type of evidence because the many police departments have a preservation protocol that allows the evidence to be overwritten when time passes.
Mr. Sheridan, Could I just stop you for a moment? I mean, I understand Please. Your argument is that we should be extending Minnesota law and setting aside whether that's something this court can even do. I mean, it seems to me that there needs to be some sort of a showing that the destroyed or lost evidence would be somehow exculpatory. Do we have a record for us to reach that conclusion in this case?
And Your Honor, that is the standard that was in was created out of California versus Trombetta and Arizona versus Youngblood. It is that very standard that we are asking this court to find is inadequate to adequately protect a person's right to a fair trial and due process. The reason for that is that the standard as it currently exists requires us to prove, right, the person who never had the evidence to prove that it would have been exculpatory.
But if we agree with you that more of a balancing approach makes sense, I mean, here we have a record where you have an audio recording of the breath test procedure. You've got, I think, two witnesses. You've got the breath test results themselves. So how would you balance out the destruction of one piece of evidence as opposed to all of the evidence, all of the relevant evidence?
Sure. What we have, Your Honor, is an audio recording of the implied consent process itself, not of the testing process itself. So the recording itself is through the breath test advisory. And once the person agreed to submit to the test, the recording ends at that point in time. What we're looking at is the process itself. And this isn't some hypothetical nonsense. In fact, Ms. Wolfgram and I have another case going on right now where, just as in this case, the officer testified that he complied with all of the procedures necessary to ensure accuracy and reliability. But in that case, there was a video recording showing that, in fact, he was in a different room preparing a police report, allowed the defendant to use the bathroom during the period when he was supposed to be under observation. And in that case, the state actually agreed to dismiss the 0.08 or more charge because the implied consent court in the companion implied consent case had determined that the test was unreliable. And Ms. Wolfgram's office went along with that finding and just dismissed the 0.08 or more charge. And again, we have the same police department, actually. And in that case, the same testimony that, oh yeah, absolutely, I complied with the procedures to ensure accuracy and reliability. But there was a video clearly establishing something other than that. So in that particular case where the video was preserved and we were able to look at it, obviously we could prove the exculpatory nature of that because we had the evidence and an opportunity to review it. The standard established in Youngblood says that now, having never seen that evidence, I'm obligated to prove that it would have been similar to the video I was just describing. That it would have also established that the procedures necessary to ensure accuracy and reliability were not filed in that particular case. Were not followed. I knew I got a word wrong in there. In that particular case. So again, the idea that it's that.
So, Mr. Sheridan, it seems to me that your argument is strikingly similar to the one that the Supreme Court heard in State versus Hawkinson. Now, I could be wrong about that, but I was surprised to see that that your brief doesn't have any reference to the case. Well, so you must have distinguished it in your own mind. And if you would share that with me, I would appreciate it.
Sure. Hawkinson is a case where the defendant was arguing under the Youngblood rule that we still prevail.
But it's the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they are specifically considering whether to diverge from Youngblood, whether bad faith is required where a request has been made, as in your case, where the defendant has made a request for evidence, and then the evidence is destroyed. And the Supreme Court, it seems to me, they didn't look at the civil standard, which I have other questions about why that would be adopted, but they didn't look at the civil standard, but they did consider a due process argument, very similar to the one that you're making.
They did, but they did it in the context of everybody assuming that Youngblood is the law of the land, and therefore we're going to analyze this under a Youngblood analysis. What I'm arguing here is that we now know through, through Mr. Youngblood's exoneration that the very standard that bears his name is inadequate to protect a person's due process rights.
So, and this is a slight shift, Mr. Sheridan. It sounds to me like you're saying we should set aside Hawkinson because it did not focus on the Minnesota Constitution. It relied on the U.S. Constitution. Is that what you're saying?
Sorry. Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying.
Okay. So then let's try to use your test, because I find your test a little hard to follow, and it would help me if you used it. Let's use the fact scenario in the Youngblood case. So what would have happened in the Youngblood case if it had happened in Minnesota, we were applying the Minnesota due process clause the way you suggest, how would that case have proceeded?
Applying the civil standard.
Well, it's your test. You tell me. I don't really follow it. To me, your language in your brief isn't the same as the civil test that I'm pretty familiar with. So you tell me, how would the test go?
Sure. Frankly, in the instance of Youngblood, we don't have to get too awfully creative, because the Arizona Court of Appeals reversed Mr. Youngblood's conviction. So they already applied a standard that basically said,
I want you to tell me how the test works. I know the procedural history of Youngblood.
Sure.
So getting go ahead. There.
So my apologies. Yeah. The standard that I would advocate, and one that I think is appropriate, is that if the evidence is material to the case and was in one party's possession, and the evidence was then destroyed while in that party's possession, the remedy for that should be that whatever was present, in this case, whatever was present on the video recording, is simply unusable.
So that confuses me, though, because in Youngblood, it means that the child victim wouldn't have testified.
No.
I'm just totally taken aback by that concept, Mr. Sheridan. So I must be missing something in your thinking. So help me out. Because the evidence that was unable to be used in Youngblood, if I understand it correctly, was the semen, right? Because it wasn't properly preserved. And so testing was unable to be conducted at that time.
Correct.
So how does your test work? I'm lost.
And it may well be that the remedy in those circumstances is what it should have been in Youngblood, and that is dismissal of the charge, because the state failed to preserve the evidence he needed to defend himself, then the charge should have been dismissed, and appropriately so, as Mr. Youngblood was innocent of the crime that he was charged with. In this case, the remedy may be something lesser, because again, the state could still proceed under the theory that my client
the influence. Help me out. So in other sexual assault cases where evidence is lost, which certainly does happen, it is unfortunate. And we're in the assumption here, this is not bad faith destruction by law enforcement. So you're telling me that in those cases, if the defendant is able to establish what, that then the charges would be dismissed. Any evidence? In the sexual assault case, or only evidence what connected with, I don't know. Help me out.
Sure, the balancing would still have to take place by a district court in the circumstances. The 13 states that have rejected Youngblood for their under their state constitutions have all devised a balancing approach.
Are we balancing? Maybe if you explain that to me, I will follow your reasoning a little better, because I'm sorry, I'm not. I didn't see you write out a balancing test in your brief. The language I saw was, if the evidence is in the state's exclusive possession and it is lost or destroyed, then any evidence that would have been preserved cannot be offered, which it doesn't sound like a balancing test, actually. So I think you must add something to any evidence that has certain qualities. So what, that the defense would rely upon, or I don't
know.
Well,
potentially, the language that brings about the Youngblood analysis is the distinction, and it actually comes from Hawkinson, the difference between potentially useful evidence and exculpatory evidence. And that is a distinction that I think is unfair to a defendant, and stacked in a way that it certainly in my research in Minnesota, no defendant has ever been able to attain that level of proof to overcome that insurmountable barrier of first proving that evidence you never saw was going to exonerate you. And second, then to get into the mind of the person who destroyed it. I follow your argument
on that. I mean, you certainly make a good point that we can't point to cases where that test has resulted in a defendant being able to apply Youngblood to the defendant's favor. So help me out on what does this balancing test look like? We balance what? How do we know that the evidence is of the sort that then the charges will be dismissed? That's what I'm.
Sure. And what I can do, Your Honor, and I apologize, and I should have done this when I briefed it, but as I was preparing for my oral argument, I did start to expand my research and start looking at what other states had done for some instruction on what a substitute test might look like. I can direct the court to Pena versus State. This is a Texas case that actually goes through and identifies all the states that have abandoned Youngblood in favor of their own state constitutional balancing test. It's at 226 Southwest 2nd, 634. The interesting thing about they take you through a history and the balancing tests that other states have applied, any of which would be better to the one that we're currently not using here in Minnesota. So that's a place to start. I guess, in my particular case, the particular remedy that I seek is that this was something I asked for, something I warned them that was going to disappear, something that disappeared as I had warned them it was going to.
Mr. Sheridan, if I can jump in as your time winds down, if I can jump in.
Sure, absolutely.
And this might be kind of a lightning round for you here. First off, there's a long delay between when you make the request and when you find out that the city has actually asked the police department to get the video. It's like 8 months. Is that right?
Yes.
And you're not saying that delay itself is bad faith. You're not trying to meet the Youngblood standard. You're trying to supplant it with something else.
Well, and we argued below that it was bad faith, applying Youngblood.
But to us, it seems like you're now arguing or almost conceding the point that if we applied the Youngblood due process test, that the facts in this case would not satisfy the test.
Again, I can't get into the head of the people who allowed the evidence to be destroyed, which is why Youngblood is an insurmountable standard. I can infer bad faith by virtue of the fact that it got destroyed despite my warnings to the contrary. But I also know the players. I know Ms. Wolfgram. I know they aren't doing this on purpose. Can I establish bad faith for people who I don't believe acted in bad faith? No. My point is that we need to change the standards so that the behavior of the police, of the prosecutors, because they understand there is actually a consequence for not turning over this evidence. That's what needs to happen, is that we need to retrain the state side of the V so that they will behave toward this evidence in a way that is respectful to the process, to the fairness of the process. I see that my time has expired. Judge, you're muted, sorry.
Thanks for the reminder. So counsel for respondent, we are ready when you're ready.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Cassandra Wolfgram, and I represent the state and the city of Invergrove Heights in this driving while impaired appeal. This case is straightforward. The facts are not in dispute. Mr. Troyer was charged with DWI. He requested discovery, including the booking room video. Discovery was provided, but not the booking room video.
If I could jump in, because I noticed that the two of you refer to this video differently. You refer to it as a booking room video. Mr. Sheridan calls it a video of the entire process. So maybe you can address whether you think and why you think your characterization is more accurate. Is it just the booking process where he's you know, getting a fingerprint and getting his picture taken and filling out the form? Or is it actually the testing process, which would be very different than a booking video?
So in the Invergrove Heights Police Department where this occurred, there is a large room. The booking process occurs in there. There is kind of a side hallway where the implied consent would occur. It is the same video that would have recorded it. It's all part of the same type.
And it's one video. It's not like there's a video of the booking process separate from the testing process.
Correct. It would all be saved as one video. Yes.
Thank you.
As the court's aware, when the city requested the booking room video, it had been destroyed pursuant to city retention policies. It was automatically erased after 90 days. The application of the law in this case is also not in dispute. Mr. Troyer has not claimed that there is any Brady violation, which would mean that the state had exculpatory evidence that we did not provide. Mr. Troyer also does not claim that there was a Youngblood violation. Youngblood is different as that it applies if there is potentially useful evidence. As the district court found, at best, this video could have been potentially useful. But under Youngblood, you then have the state, you have to prove that there is bad faith on the part of the tests, on the state.
And I think Ms. Wolfgram, that the whole point is Youngblood is not the right standard. The Minnesota courts should look to its own constitutions and provide broader due process protections. I guess my question is this, have Minnesota courts found due process violations based on the existing standard?
Your Honor, it is, under the current standard, it is hard. I would have to double check, but I think there's maybe been one case, and it's been if there, I'd have to find the name in my name, but my understanding was that the defense had requested discovery multiple times without a response. And in that case, you know, the state continued not to respond. And so there was a finding of bad faith in there, but yes, it's otherwise in general, it has not been a finding of bad faith.
Ms. Wolfgram, I'm curious because I see the appellant's argument as kind of in two parts, well, really three parts. Mm-hmm. Part one is if you apply Youngblood, there's some facts that maybe you could satisfy the Youngblood due process test in this case, given the 8-month delay, which is troublesome because at the start of the request, if the city had asked for the video at that point, they would have been able to comply. It wouldn't have had it been destroyed. So there is two parts here. There's the policy that a video is destroyed after 90 days, and there's the delay. So I think that's part one of the argument, is that under Youngblood, it would be potentially satisfied. I think the primary argument, though, is the second part, which is that we should have a different due process test than Youngblood. And I think you've addressed some of that. The third part to me, and this is the part that I think might be glossed over a little bit, is the remedy. Put aside Brady due process violations, because that's a post-conviction or post-trial due process issue. But I'm not aware of too many times where this court or the U.S. Supreme Court or other courts have applied the exclusionary rule to a due process violation. And so I'm wondering if the proper remedy here is really dismissal, which wasn't asked for below. The only dismissal motion below was for lack of probable cause, not because of a due process problem. So what is the correct remedy for a due process violation before trial? Because that's what we're looking at here. Is it dismissal or does the exclusionary rule apply? And what's the authority we look to determine what the remedy is for failing the due process test, whatever we decide that test to be?
Judge Brian, you kind of went over a few things. So first, I'm just going to address the fact that if you go back to State v. Hawkinson, the Minnesota Supreme Court has affirmed that Illinois v. Fisher, that the discovery request does not change the need for the finding of bad faith. And in Hawkinson, there was a discovery request and they said blood tests, and then they waited and then they came back after the 1 year had passed and said, oh, we want the blood test sample, and it had been destroyed. And so that the court said we can talk about the delay in that time, but that doesn't automatically make a finding of bad faith. As to what would happen, there's no argument that there was any bad faith in this case. There was no bad faith. Mr. Troyer has not argued that the state acted in bad faith. So pursuant to the law, this would be there's nothing that would occur with this booking video here. There's no basis to exclude the DMT test results, which pursuant to law, those are automatically admissible as long as it's conducted by a certified DMT operator and there's an indicator of reliability. Mr. Troyer has not contested the reliability of those test results, and he did have an opportunity to challenge those. Under the law, every criminal driver who is arrested for DWI can obtain an independent test. He did not take advantage of that. And I would just, you mentioned sanctions, and Rule 9 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure does discuss what would happen if there's missing discovery and what the court can do. And the court does have authority to, for example, find the party in contempt if they are willingly not providing discovery.
This isn't a rule-based request. This is a due process constitutional-based request. So as you get to that piece of it, I'm wondering, when have we applied the exclusionary rule to a due process violation that occurs before trial?
Well, Your Honor, we do in DWI cases quite frequently. For example, there's cases that come up for denial of attorney time. And if we find that the officers did not provide sufficient attorney time for a criminal driver, then the test results are thrown out in those cases as a due process violation.
Do you think that that's rooted in the statute? Because the statute goes through the process so clearly, and if you don't follow that statute, then the remedy is a statutory one? Or do you think that that remedy of exclusion comes from some application of either the state or U.S. due process clause?
That actually comes directly from due process clause, because it's finding that this is an important part of the criminal process, that defendants should have a right to have counsel. And so if they do not have that time to contact an attorney, to be able to speak to an attorney, then that is a violation of their rights. And so it's based on the due process violation there. Your Honors, I just wanted to bring up one more thing. Mr. Troyer has talked about the civil spoliation cases and that there's a balancing test. And one of the factors in that balancing test is materiality of the evidence that is destroyed. There have been no allegations that this booking video was material at all. We have the DMT test results. We have the officers who testified, who observed the entire observation period, who observed the testing results. There have been no allegations that there were any irregularities during the testing period. And it's important to note that had there been an irregularity, such as Mr. Troyer had burped or if he had vomited, he would still have to prove that that actually affected his test results before they were excluded. Under Mr. Troyer's proposed rule today, he would have a greater protection because of the inadvertent destruction of the booking video with no apparent evidentiary value than a driver who actually burped or smoked or chewed gum during the test. Your Honors, as you are aware, Mr. Troyer's argument today is about changing the law. As he acknowledged in his petition to the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, this court today, does not have that authority. So as of today, you are going to have to affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Let me ask you about that, counsel. Mr. Sheridan's argument, as I understand it, is that Hawkinson doesn't bind us because it didn't resolve the issue based on the Minnesota Constitution. Now, I realize that you have a section of your brief which does address in which instances our Supreme Court, at least, has interpreted the Minnesota Constitution mm-hmm. differently. And so I already see your response to that, but that is, I'd like you to respond to what you just argued, which is saying you're really giving us two paths to follow. One is to say simply, oh, we can't change the law because we're just an error correcting court, quote unquote. The other is you're saying, but wait a second, you know, to the extent this is a question of first impression, which we decide all the time, and it has to do with the Minnesota Constitution, we should go down your path. So which is it? What are you arguing today?
Your Honors, I would say that I'm arguing that the court really can't change the law. It's pretty well established. And in Hawkinson and other cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court has reaffirmed that they follow the same due process laws as the U.S. Supreme Court. They have adopted these standards. In Hawkinson, they specifically adopted the bad faith from Illinois v. Fisher. And so this is not new law. It's not just based on the Minnesota or the U.S. Constitution. They've also looked at the Minnesota Constitution, said they are nearly identical. And so we apply the same tests in both cases.
That's how you read Hawkinson. It's already resolved the Minnesota constitutional issue.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Is there anything else, counsel? I didn't mean to take you off course, but it seemed like a natural segue.
No, I'd like to thank you all and just ask that this court affirm the lower court's decision today.
Any other questions from the panel for the respondent? All right. And so I think Mr. Sheridan will give the marshal a few minutes to reset the clock. And then we're ready for you. Got 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Let me start with the idea that somehow officer testimony is the equivalent of a video and we should just be satisfied with everything the officer has to say. As the other scenario I already laid out for you in the case involving Ms. Wolfgrim's office, clearly the officer said he did everything according to Hoyle, but the video showed something quite different. So the materiality, any questions about the materiality ends at the point that I make a specific request that you preserve and disclose the video recording. Right? It may not mean anything to you because you as a prosecutor want to rely entirely upon police officers providing nothing but 100% truthful and accurate testimony in court, and therefore it's an adequate substitute for anything that might have been preserved. But this is an independent piece of evidence that I have used on multiple occasions to establish that the officer's testimony is incorrect, that it is not truthful, or that it is at least not accurate. And to obtain results of keeping tainted evidence out of my client's trials. This idea that somehow an officer's testimony negates the materiality of a particular piece of evidence that I asked for by name and provided a warning that it would be recycled if they didn't ask for it immediately, and yet it was destroyed. So I dispute that there's any question about the materiality of that evidence. The materiality was obvious the moment I asked for it. Go ahead.
Mr. Sheridan, I'd like you to address, and maybe I misunderstood it. It's really Judge Bryan's question about the remedy that's appropriate in this case. So you asked for exclusion of evidence below, and now I hear you asking for dismissal. You're still asking for exclusion?
The dismissal was inevitable once this evidence was excluded. We were asking for exclusion of the test result. And yes, I then asked for dismissal of the charge based on a lack of probable cause. The argument being that once this evidence is excluded, there is no longer probable cause to support the charge of having an alcohol concentration above the legal limit because there is no longer a test. So I apologize if there was confusion about that. Ultimately,
no, that's fine. And then I think the we heard from respondents counsel as to the legal authority for that. And as I understood her response, but you can correct me and give your own version. That's fairly routine to use a due process violation to exclude evidence. And then in your case, as you said, based on these facts, it would actually result in dismissal.
And I don't know.
Do you agree with that? I was supposed to be a question. I didn't say it very well.
having done the case that resulted in the right to counsel at the time of testing, I do know that it happened to have been under the Minnesota constitutional right to counsel, not the right to due process. I think they're all intertwined to a certain extent here, but it is actually a right to counsel violation that was then codified in the rewritten statute to say that there was also a statutory remedy. But I do agree that it was a constitutional remedy. not necessarily a statutory one, although again, in the rewriting of the statute, it became a question of both. But the, you know, again, the remedy is going to change on a case-by-case basis, you know, again, which just goes to this question of what is the balance of the interests involved. And in a case like this, where there was an absolute request for a particular piece of evidence, and that evidence was destroyed, and that evidence would have contained the entire testing process, the balance was that should have been excluded. And using a...
Seeing your time run, I'm trying to tie up a couple of loose ends. So the argument that we heard from Respondents' Counsel as to this court's role on this issue. So we have the federal issue, sure, question of due process and how to treat lost evidence fairly well nailed down by the U.S. Supreme Court and our own Minnesota Supreme Court in Hawkinson. You even agree with that, I think. So on the state side, state constitutional side, can you point us to some case law where Minnesota has applied a different due process standard, preferably as to this type of issue, but in any criminal issue?
And I would have cited it in the brief if it had been available to me. I do think this is a question of first impression, because the Hawkinson, Mr. Hawkinson was not asking the court to apply the Minnesota Constitution. He was arguing his case under the U.S. Constitution and arguing it under the standard from Arizona versus Youngblood, which is, I mean, I think we all have to agree, is a failed standard. It failed the very person after whom it is named, right? It is designed to keep innocent people from being sent to prison. That's the point of due process. And yet in the very name of Youngblood, Mr. Youngblood was sent to prison for a crime he did not commit. The standard is a failure. The question is, what do we replace it with? I'm seeking under it, because the United States Supreme Court has not abandoned this obviously failed standard, that we in Minnesota are entitled to greater protection than that which resulted in Mr. Youngblood spending a decade of his life in prison for a crime he did not commit.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate the arguments that you presented to us today. And with that, this case is now submitted to the court for its decision, and you will receive a decision within the statutory timeframe.